and Agritalia SRL and Tessa SRL versus United States and Riviana Foods Incorporated and Treehouse Foods Incorporated. Counsel, when I call your name, please introduce yourselves to the court. David Simon?
Yes, I'm David Simon of the Law Office of David Simon, representing the plaintiffs.
Mr. Simon, is there anybody else joining you today?
John Kankel is here, but I am presenting the oral argument.
Okay. Suzanne Bay for defendant?
Thank you. Suzanne Bay from the Department of Justice for the United States. Karen Huff of the Department of Commerce is also on the line.
Defendant intervener, Elizabeth Johnson?
Good afternoon. I'm Elizabeth Johnson, Kelly Dry and Warren for the defendant interveners, Treehouse Foods and Riviana Foods. David Smith of our office is also on the line today.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, is that everybody? Mr. Simon, you're the plaintiff, so why don't you start off?
All right, thank you very much. May it please the court, I'm David Simon for the plaintiffs, and we're addressing three issues today. We begin with the issue of the coding of protein in the databases. And as a summary of our position, I would say this. As a factual matter, the Commerce Department's protein coding causes physically identical goods to be reported as if they were dissimilar and causes physically dissimilar goods to be reported as if they were identical to each other. And all of the parties have agreed to this proposition. Nobody disputes the proposition that there is a mismatch in the protein field between U.S. product and home market product, and also, incidentally, between U.S. product and the cost of production database.
Well, then, I guess I misunderstand this a little bit. If you calculate the protein percentage and it comes in over, I don't know, 12 or something like that, it's
12 and
premium,
a half.
12 and a half, it's premium. And if you calculate it and it comes in under 12 and a half, it's not premium. But how would that result in products that are dissimilar being compared to each other?
The starting place of the problem is actually the questionnaire itself. The questionnaire instructs the respondent to report the protein content according to the label on the finished goods. You know, both virtually all countries, but Italy and the United States in particular, require nutrition panels on the food products that go to consumers. So when you're going to the grocery store, you can
see
that.
I understand that.
Okay.
But is it that if it says 11% on the Italian label, it would not be calculated to be 11% on the American label?
That's exactly right.
Okay.
Because the FDA rules, the Food and Drug Administration rules, have a different conversion factor from the Italian rules.
Okay.
Okay, just as a technical matter, you can't weigh the protein in the food. What you do is
you measure
by
the nitrogen.
Laboratory, you measure the nitrogen. You can ascertain the amount of nitrogen in a food sample, and then in the United States, you take that nitrogen and percentage and multiply it by 6.25. And in Italy, you multiply it by 5.7. So what that means is that if I have a package of American pasta with a label protein of 6.25, it's not, I'm sorry, of 12.5%, it's not going to be identical to an Italian pasta with a label protein of 12.5%.
Okay.
So there is a mismatch between the physical attributes of the pasta and what's coming out of, let's say, a rote response to the instruction of the questionnaire.
Okay.
And in your
questionnaire response, or at some point, you've explained this to Commerce.
In fact, no. We didn't explain it, period. I mean, I don't have to get into reasons or anything.
Okay.
It's simply not there, and it didn't come up until the verification.
Okay.
No question about that. It didn't come up until the verification, and then at that point, there was a conversation, and thereafter we submitted our post-verification comments that are in the appendix that you have, and so forth. But putting all that aside, the fact remains that there is a mismatch between the American market pasta and the Italy market pasta. And it's a critical mismatch because the protein content defines the difference between premium pasta and standard pasta.
Okay.
So because we are taking the information directly from the label, all of the American pasta, which is all 12.5% per the label, is being compared to premium pasta in Italy.
Okay. This may be completely beside the point, but is there anything different from which review are we in?
Oh, 22nd or something like that.
So did this particular question change any from, as far as you know, from review number 1 to review 21?
Oh, sure. This idea of this field, let's say, of the database, the protein field of the database, was first put in the 12th review in 2007-2008. And then there was a little, for a couple of years, there was a state of flux. Different respondents thought in different ways and so forth. And so in the 15th review, Commerce said, well, wait a minute. Everybody simply report according to the label. The label we know the label is the label. It won't change. I don't care about lab results or anything like that. Just do it per the label.
Okay. So then you followed the instructions and you reported it the way that you were supposed to. How did this come up at verification?
Your Honor, we did. We, yes and no, followed the instructions. In the domestic database, we reported per the label.
Right.
In the U.S. database, we reported per the label, except that we converted the label protein, 12.5%, to what it would have been measured under the Italian protocol, which is 11.4%. So the impact is that in the U.S. database, while the label says premium pasta, 12.5%, The fact is the physical pasta is not premium. It's standard pasta at 11.4%. And so we reported the U.S. product as standard pasta.
U.S. product would have been standard pasta in Italy.
Yes. Exactly.
Okay.
And just because of the difference in the protein
measure. I understand.
Okay, and then coming back to your question, at verification, the analyst goes through basically every field of the database and says, let me see your support for this. And when we got to the field for protein, you know, the protein is one of the physical characteristics that make up the control number, the CONNUM, if you're familiar with that methodology.
Yes, ma'am.
So Commerce wants to verify each of the fields of the CONNUM. And when they got to the protein field, they said, okay, let's look at your packaging material so we can see what's written on the nutrition panel.
Right.
And we got it, and there it says 12.5%. And they said, oh, your reporting is wrong because you're reporting this as standard pasta, not premium pasta. So that's how it came up at verification. They had never previously they'd never asked for or looked at any labels, say in a supplemental questionnaire or something like that. So they didn't really think about that field from anything I can tell from the record until they got to verification.
All right, just so that I'm clear, in your questionnaire response, you did not, in fact, if the questionnaire asked you to take the protein percentages from the label, you did not, in fact, do that. Is that true?
On the U.S. side, in the database, we did not, in fact, do that.
Okay, very good.
Okay.
So I understand you didn't do it, and I understand you believe you had a perfectly good reason for not doing it.
That's right. And the perfectly good reason was the mismatch, and nobody in this case claims that the matches are correct. They claim we should have done this, we should have done that, we should have, you know, given the information earlier, what have you. The petitioner at one point claims, well, the difference we're talking about is too small to be important. But, you know, we can deal with that. The critical point, as far as I'm concerned, and I believe the court should be concerned, is that nobody claims that the matches flowing from the questionnaire are accurate. And if that's the case, if they're not accurate, then you can't use them as a matter of
Is it also the case that no one claims that the Very good. I got it.
Okay. And, I mean, just a few more critical points on this issue. We need to remember that the protein on the label is a proxy for the physical content of the pasta. Commerce doesn't really care about the protein on the label as such. It only cares about the physical characteristic of the merchandise because of the statutory language and because that's the way it is. And so when Commerce put in this requirement per the label in the 15th review, Commerce said, and I'm quoting, the department relies on the protein content information reported on the label to identify the physical characteristic of protein, end quote. So we're always talking about the pasta. We don't really care about the label.
Okay.
Okay. And my argument flows from all of what we've just said. It's simply the case that if we follow the questionnaire slavishly in a rote manner, then we're going to be giving information that conflicts with the other instruction of the questionnaire, which is that, I quote again, identical products should be assigned the same troll number in each record all the time. That's a real problem. I mean, that instruction is in direct conflict with the instruction to report per the label. Of course, had we said all this early in the case, you know, we might not be in front of you today, but we have to take the facts as they are.
Right.
All right. That's the first half of the argument about protein content. The second half of the argument goes a little bit into the history of things, because what we are arguing is that the entire method of coding protein between 12.5 and above and below 12.5 is unsupported ab initio from AR-15 on by any substantial evidence. The protein coding field is just fatally flawed and always has been. Look, here's the flow of the argument. In the 12th review, where Commerce first added the protein coding, Commerce was trying to find, they knew that there was a difference between premium pasta and standard pasta. They knew that. Respondents had been working on, you know, trying to get them to do a different kind of coding. This is before the protein field.
And what is the actual difference to the consumer? Is it more al dente? Does it taste better?
No. I mean, it's not on the record. I can talk about it.
Yeah, just
it's
tell
not
me.
Really on the record. The pasta is a carbohydrate, right? It's
certainly
made
is.
Up of carbohydrates. And the function of the protein in the common term for this protein is gluten. And the gluten, what happens is when you cook the pasta, the gluten forms protein chains, and they envelop the starch chains so that the starch can't just leach out into the water and the protein and the pasta collapses in the boiling water. So the protein is like a mesh that's holding the carbohydrate in the food. And the better that mesh, the better the carb is held in the food. So everybody will agree that protein content is a good proxy for quality. There are
okay.
other measures
That's good
of
enough.
Quality.
That's good enough.
Yeah.
I got it.
Okay, fine. All right. But where do you draw the line? When you go into the supermarket, you don't know what's a premium pasta and what's a normal pasta, you know, unless you're a fairly sophisticated consumer. And as a general proposition, you can tell from the price. Better things cost more. We can accept that. But when Commerce added this protein code in AR-12, they said, We know there's a difference between premium and normal. What is it? It's in the protein, okay? We agree with that. Then they said, you know, in the Italian commodity market, the grain board, they have a 12.5% break point for semolina protein. So when Gigi goes to buy semolina, it can buy premium, and it's always going to be at least 12.5%, or it can buy standard, and it's always going to be something between 11% and 12.49%, let's say. All right. So, and that was it. Commerce said, oh, we're going to use the semolina standard as our break point for pasta. Why? Why do they think that the semolina standard break point is the commercially significant difference? I mean, commercially significant is a term of art, you know, coming from Pescara-Mares and those cases. Why did commerce think that that 12.5% break point constituted a commercially significant difference vis-a-vis finished goods, pasta? And really important is the fact that whenever a pasta producer produces pasta, he always, invariably, blends semolina from his different silos. A company like Zara or Gigi will have 6, 8, 10 semolina silos. And the semolina is delivered to the factory by truck. A truckload, the truck is the size of the silo, and so they blow the semolina into the silo. And the production manager, the maestro pastai, will select, say, 40% from silo 1, 8% from silo 2, and the balance from silo 3. And those will be blown into the conveyor system and blended for the finished goods. And they might be blended for different protein contents and other physical characteristics that we don't care about in dumping, but the factory cares about. Okay, so nobody buys 12.5% semolina and puts it in their production line. Always they will blend a bunch of different semolinas. Therefore, you can't assume that the break point for premium versus standard semolina has anything to do with the break point for premium versus standard pasta. And commerce made no effort. There's nothing in any of the historical record, the ID memos, and so forth. There is nothing to show that commerce made any attempt to ascertain whether there was a 12.5% break point in the pasta market in either Italy or the United States. And this is separate and apart from the protein measurement issue. Let's just assume that it's all, we don't have that issue for the moment. So our argument is that the entire use of the protein coding field is unsupported by substantial evidence ab initio. It's always been bad. It's always been fatally flawed. And the government doesn't really address this argument in their response brief. And the petitioner doesn't fundamentally address it either, and they'll give you their arguments, but at the end of the day, the historical record is the historical record. And so when we ask for a remand, we ask for a remand on two separate grounds, both of which we believe constitute grounds for remand. The first is the inaccuracy in model matching. If the model matches are inaccurate, the calculation is inaccurate, and that can't be allowed to exist. And the second, of course, is what I have just been explaining, that the way the field was constructed ab initio was legally inadequate. And the passage of time doesn't cure that. It's still legally inadequate. Commerce still has no idea whether the pasta market uses that kind of breakpoint at any stage of the channels of distribution.
Okay.
If I can just take a sec, we made an argument that there, going back to the first point about the protein content, that the questionnaire contained a latent ambiguity in the instruction for reporting protein. And there's been a certain amount of back and forth on this, and I just want to state our position very clearly. It's this. Suppose the Commerce Department, one of the physical characteristics was length. Length, how long something is. And Commerce says everything from 1 to 5 is a code 1, and from 6 and above is a code 2. Well, without stating, that seems unambiguous. 1 to 5 and 6 and above, no ambiguity there. But we know from information extrinsic to that sentence that length is a variable that for which you have to supply the units. 1 to 5 inches is something very different from 1 to 5 centimeters. So there is a latent ambiguity in the instruction to report 1 to 5 and 6 and above according to such and such code. That ambiguity becomes apparent, latent, when you understand that there are different units at work. And we have exactly the same situation here, because 12.5% sounds like it's unambiguous until you know that the FDA measurement is different from the Italian measurement. And at that point, you have to stop and wonder.
Okay.
So that's the argument about latent ambiguity. I don't think it's central, but it came up enough that I think it's worth addressing.
Okay, fine. Thanks.
Let's see. I think that's all that I have. I might have something in rebuttal on this topic after we hear from the other side. Do you want me to pause and you listen to the other side, or shall I go ahead with the shape classification and the AFA for the pay dates?
Yeah, let's hear the other lawyers, and then we'll come back to shape.
Thank you, Your Honor. I take this as permission to go ahead. This is So Sun Bae on behalf of the United States. May it please the court, and just to make sure I understand before we go ahead, you're wanting us and then defendant intervener to discuss the protein content issue, and then we'll take the next two issues in turn by party as well.
Yes. As part of the protein content issue, I hope you'll talk a little bit about why you chose 12.5%. But, yes, that's what we'd like to do. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. And there are, I was originally planning to start out with some issues that I think, that I believe are intrinsic to both the protein content and the shape, but I'll try to cabinet just in terms of the protein content for now. So I'd actually like to start with one of the last things that that plaintiff's counsel stated, which was the comparison regarding the ambiguity or lack thereof.
I'm sorry to do this to you, but it's part of your argument that the instructions say use the label. They didn't use the label. They didn't tell you until verification that they didn't use the label. And so they didn't. Facts available, at least, are warranted. Is that part of your argument?
Well, I mean, I think that's part of our argument, not in the sense that facts available necessarily are warranted. In this case, we actually, and I think petitioners noted, that Commerce did not employ facts available or AFA against plaintiffs, even though they may have been well justified in doing so, given that plaintiffs did not only fail to comply, but they actually certified that they complied with Commerce's instructions. And that's where I think the unambiguity comes in.
Okay.
Plaintiff's counsel makes this deal out of it being ambiguous as to what 12.5% applies to, but Commerce's instructions explicitly say, and they have explicitly said also in the two or more prior reviews in which Gigi Zara were mandatory respondents, to report the protein code on a below or above 12.5% basis as stated on the label of the product. So there was no ambiguity, latent or patent, as to what Commerce meant in its instructions, given that Commerce expressly directed plaintiffs to report as stated on the label of the product.
What did they do in the two previous reviews?
Plaintiffs in the two previous reviews, as far as my understanding goes, also certified that they reported the protein content as stated on the label of the product. Without going back and reopening the record and looking at all that, I couldn't say right now whether...
Okay, very good.
Yeah, but they did state that they reported in accordance with Commerce's instructions, as far as I'm aware, just as they did in this review. The difference is that in this review, Commerce conducted a verification and verified against the labels of the product as... per their instructions, and discovered that Gigi Zara had misreported the protein content and explicitly disregarded Commerce's instructions. And I think that, again, just shows that Gigi Zara not only failed to raise the issues in response to Commerce's initial questionnaire, and I'll note, and I think we pointed out in our brief, that Commerce does state in its initial documents that a party should reach out and contact it with any questions. If plaintiffs had any questions regarding any apparent discrepancy between the Italian conversion measurements for protein and the U.S. conversion measurements for protein, the only correct course would have been to go to Commerce and state that, hey, we think that these percentage differences lead to different outcomes, rather than simply gerrymander the answers for the U.S. database in order to characterize their pasta as standard instead of premium. And again, this has come up in multiple prior reviews in which Gigi Zara themselves participated, and they never brought up this issue. And toward plaintiff's second point, they never brought up the issue that they believe that Commerce's methodology regarding protein content was invalid ab initio, as they keep asserting now. If they had believed it was void ab initio, then that begs the question as to why Gigi Zara never raised the issue until they got caught at verification. And I'll note that not only did Gigi Zara participate in this review and multiple prior reviews without raising their theory that the entire methodology was flawed, but that Commerce has had this methodology in place for over a decade and consulted, in my understanding at least, with both domestic and foreign interested parties in making this determination. And I'll move next to...
hold on a second.
Your Honor's...
Hold on.
Of course.
You say that they... But did they ever publish, write down the reason why they chose the 12.5%?
Yes, Your Honor. They wrote it down in the IDM for the 2007-2008 review, which is when they determined to include the protein field. And, excuse me, Your Honor, I'm a bit congested. Just for background purposes, the reason that this 2007-2008 review existed and this 12.5% protein content line was established was actually because Commerce was modifying the PASTA condom in order to make it more transparent and consistent across parties. And so when they did
Hold on a second. What was the reason for the 12.5% breakpoint?
Well, as Commerce... stated in its IDM for that review, and I believe quoted in its IDM for this review at pages 7 and 8, Commerce explained its decision to use the 12.5% protein content as the dividing line for premium and standard pasta and based it on four different factors, which I believe both we and petitioners mentioned in our brief. And I'll note to start that it's Commerce's determination that they needed to find some sort of dividing line for premium pasta and standard pasta. And as this court and perhaps the Federal Circuit has held, just the presence of a threshold does not by itself render it invalid or arbitrary. The reason that Commerce chose the 12.5 is that, first of all, they came to the conclusion that certain brands of pasta were marketed and sold as premium products of pasta, which is distinct from standard products, and that these premium pasta brands had certain physical characteristics. And then the second factor that they considered was...
And when you say physical characteristics, do you mean protein content or carbohydrate content? Or
I believe that they were referring to protein content. They may have also been referring to one of the other categories, but I believe in talking about the protein content, they were talking about the protein content or, as Mr. Simon described, the characteristics in cooking that stem as a result of this protein content. And then Commerce, as a second factor, considered that there was not a clearly defined or standardized method at the time that they developed this methodology of identifying premium pasta other than the protein content marked on the packages. And then third, Commerce actually did determine, and I unfortunately don't have all the background information for the 2007-2008 review directly in front of me. I'm not sure if potentially Petitioner's Counsel can explicate on it further. But the third factor is that Commerce actually did determine in this review over a decade ago that there was a clear relationship between the physical characteristics of the semolina used to produce the finished pasta and the finished pasta itself. So Commerce's determination in that regard, which again has been the same for over a decade now, is directly contrary to what Plaintiff's Counsel is asserting, which is that Commerce did not consider whether there was a relationship between the characteristics of the semolina and the pasta itself. And finally, I think going most directly to Your Honor's question is how they landed on the exact 12.5% number. The first three factors discuss more why they needed a breakpoint at all and how they arrived at this breakpoint. The 12.5% breakpoint in general, or specifically, as Commerce described in that IDM and cited to in this particular administrative review, is that it was an industry standard developed in the Italian marketplace of pasta manufacturers and semolina sellers. I know that Plaintiff's Counsel argues that this does not render that...
Yes, I understand it. I understand his argument. And
thank you.
Thank you for pointing this out.
Thank you, Your Honor. And so I think this all dovetails into my couple overarching points, which is that aside from Gigi Zara's own knowledge of this methodology and failure to raise it, is that Commerce has had this practice in place for over a decade, explained this methodology when they adopted it, further explained it in the 15th review, I think, or the 2010-2011 review, as plaintiff's counsel pointed out, as to why they decided to specifically require reporting by the label, and specifically decided to make that part of their questionnaire going forward. But that, I think plaintiffs also sort of misapprehend the prevailing standard when it comes to commerce's methodology, and that, as dictated by the Federal Circuit, is that the court will not normally second-guess, and neither can respondents, commerce's methodologies, given the significant deference afforded to commerce in determining its methodologies. This is particularly so when the methodology, as here, involves a fact-based determination. And here, I just don't think that plaintiffs have come anywhere close to establishing that commerce failed to consider crucial factors when adopting that methodology, or that the methodology itself contravenes the statute. I think that the only thing that plaintiffs can raise in favor of their argument that this methodology is in contravention of the statute.
Well, he actually seems to be saying that the methodology isn't supported by substantial evidence, that you may have expressed the methodology, but you haven't supported the methodology with substantial evidence.
Oh, well, Your Honor, I think that Commerce's explanations in the previous reviews do detract from plaintiff's argument on that point, but I think that plaintiffs have also pointed out this whole idea of identical products, and that's, I think, the language that is used in the relevant statute. But the Federal Circuit has held that products that Commerce can consider identical do not actually have to be exactly physically identical, and that commerce may disregard minor physical differences. And here, I believe that, and I think that Intervenors Council can talk more about it, that the respondent or the plaintiff here did not place any information on the record establishing that even if they could establish that there's a minor difference in this conversion between Italian measurements and U.S. measurements, I think it amounts to about 1.2% in the end. They cannot establish that this is enough to take it outside of the boundaries of what the Federal Circuit has held, that commerce can consider identical, or that there is a significant difference, significant commercial difference. I don't believe that plaintiff has placed any information on the record as to that point. Rather, it just makes conclusory statements and assumes that commerce thinks that there's a commercially significant difference, but that's simply false, as are a lot of the overarching statements that we believe that plaintiff made.
Okay. Once you discovered that the 12.5%, or that they didn't use the numbers from the label, what did you do?
Your Honor, once Commerce discovered at verification that that plaintiffs had disregarded Commerce's instructions and not reported in accordance with the label, Commerce, I believe, issued a supplemental questionnaire instructing plaintiffs to recode the protein content in accordance with the label. And plaintiffs did so under protest, and then I believe in the parties' case briefs, petitioners and respondents addressed this issue of whether Gigi Zara should have been required to recode in accordance with the label, and Commerce addressed these in its case, in its IDM, and upheld its decision to require Gigi Zara to report in accordance with the label. And I'll just point out here that, Your Honor.
That's fine. I got it. Continue with your argument, if you will.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me just look through my notes very quickly. I think that addresses the bulk of what I had to say on the protein content. I think I may have touched on this already, but I do want to just point out that plaintiff's statement that it made both in its brief and during argument that Commerce relied solely on these Italian commodity exchanges in order to come up with the methodology. It's just simply not an accurate statement, and that Commerce did, in fact, consider these four factors, explain these factors, develop them in conjunction with multiple interested parties, at least as far as I'm aware, and then further explicated on its methodology in a further review. Unless this court has any other questions, we would ask that the court sustain Commerce's final results in this regard, and we will save, of course, the discussion of the SHAPE and the AFA.
Okay, great. The defendant intervener.
Thank you, Your Honor. This is Elizabeth Johnson, and may it please the court. I want to touch on two things that plaintiff's counsel raised that we dispute. The first is that plaintiff's counsel stated no one here would disagree that the protein coding, as it stated, results in a mismatch. We do not agree with that, and that is because, as the defendant's counsel has just discussed, plaintiff's definition of identical products is a much more narrow definition than what the Federal Circuit has held in Piscara-Maris. In some ways, that case is pretty analogous to this case in that the respondent in that case was trying to claim that this super premium category of salmon, which it sold in the domestic market, should have a separate categorization in the U.S., and the court found that the distinction between premium salmon and super premium salmon wasn't commercially significant enough to distinguish in the United States, and therefore, you know, even though the product was not maybe physically identical, it was close enough to meet the department's statutory obligations to compare identical products.
Is there a price difference between plaintiff's products and other products that are in the condom?
Well, I'm sure plaintiff's counsel could speak to that, Your Honor, but what I would say is that what plaintiffs have been complaining about is their U.S. product, which is marked at 12.5% protein content. What that is going to get compared to is their Italian product, which is marked at 12.5% protein. Now, what they're saying is, under the U.S. standard, that 12.5% really equals 13.7%. But under the U.S. standard for calculating protein, both of those meet the U.S. threshold for a premium pasta product. So, you know, that's sort of what we are saying, is that that difference between 12.5% and the 13.7, which is what their product will be getting compared to, are both premium pasta products under U.S. The U.S. method of calculating protein. So that's where we see sort of this analogy to the Piscara-Maris case, is that their Italian pasta may be just a little bit higher, but it is still within that over 12.5% designation that the U.S. has for protein content for premium pasta. The second issue that we disagree with is, Mr. Simon said earlier, no one cares about the label. We do care about the label. And in fact, I would note in plaintiff's opening brief to the court on page 29, plaintiffs wrote, and I quote, GG does not disagree with Commerce's differentiation between standard and premium pasta based on protein content as expressed on the label. GG's only disagreement is with Commerce's failure to account for the difference in protein testing protocol as between the two markets. So I think the record is clear here that when Commerce decided to have some kind of differentiation between premium and standard pasta, they ultimately concluded that the only commercially important or commercially viable way of distinguishing between the two for consumers and everyone in the supply chain was to see what was printed on the label. And so I think that the record supports Commerce's decision to rely on that clear, consistent data, and GG has not contested that in the opening brief.
I don't quite get your argument. If they were calculated the same, then they would have been the same, but they're calculated differently, and so they're not the same. So why is it clear? I don't see why I'm missing why there isn't any difference here. I mean, I get the percentage difference. I get all that. But there is a difference. And may not be a material difference, but there is a difference. And so if the label really matters, the labels don't represent two things that are the same.
So what the
department has said, Your Honor, is that the label matters because that is what the consumer is looking at. So a label in the U.S. that says 12.5% protein, Commerce has decided is going to be interpreted by a U.S. consumer as premium pasta. A label in Italy, which says 12.5% protein, is going to be considered to be premium pasta by a customer there. The reason that even
really?
Though they technically, well, I mean, that's the difference in the 12.5% breakpoint. That's what Commerce decided.
But since the they're calculated differently, wouldn't they, in Italy, wouldn't it be a different number than 12.5%? It would be 12.5% as calculated in the United States, but on the label, if I were a label reader in Italy, would I be looking for 12.5%?
Well, that's my understanding, Your Honor, that we are comparing the 12.5% labels in the U.S. to the 12.5% labels in Italy. And when you make those, but when you calculate that Italian label by the U.S. standards, it's actually a higher protein percentage. It's 13.7%.
That's what I'm...
So when you, mm-hmm.
Right. So you would think that if I were an Italian label reader, I would be looking at I'd be looking for a label that has a slightly smaller number. Wouldn't I?
Well, I guess I can't speak to that necessarily, Your Honor, other than to
say...
Well,
you just told me that a consumer in Italy would look for 12.5% on the Italian label, and a consumer in the United States would look at the label in the United States for 12.5%, but they would, in fact, be different amounts.
So yes, Your Honor, they would be different amounts. Keep in mind that the department... did get that 12.5% number, as I think Defendant's Counsel has testified, based on the Italian Commodities Exchange. So that 12.5% number, the department is applying uniformly to pasta both in the United States or Italy.
They're applying the same number, but they're not getting the same, but the product is not the same.
Well, it's not exactly the same, Your Honor, but within the... case law under the Federal Circuit, which says products do not have to be identical as long as they are not
significantly
different.
I get that part of the argument, but
different.
I don't get...
Okay.
I'm sorry. I get that part of that. What I didn't understand, which are part of the argument about labels, where you said that an Italian consumer would look for 12.5% and an American consumer would look for 12.5%. That's the part of the argument.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I don't get.
Okay, I'm sorry. Well, I guess my point is that if a U.S. consumer is looking at a 12.5% label... and an Italian consumer is looking at a 12.5% label, that Italian 12.5% label, when recalculated under the U.S. standard, is actually 13.7%, both of which are considered premium pasta. So they're both premium pasta.
That's your argument. I get it.
That is my argument, Your Honor. The other point I wanted to make, and this gets actually to both the model matching arguments under protein content and shape, but I'll just raise it. It's a timeliness argument, which the government counsel has described in detail. I just want to note that in defendant intervener's brief, we cited several cases, including Maverick Tube Co., J-Tech Corp., the United States, and JBF Rack, LLC, all of which stand for the proposition that the department can reasonably refuse to consider model matching criteria arguments when they're filed after the department has issued its anti-dumping questionnaires and after respondents have submitted home market and sales data in response to those questionnaires, because it just doesn't give the department sufficient time to retrieve information or feedback from the respondents. And plaintiffs in this case have failed to discuss any of that case law in their reply brief. So they have not addressed any of those cases, which we would hold, you know, are persuasive here in finding that these claims are just far too, they were brought far too late in the proceedings. They were brought approximately 8 months after Gigi and Zara received the department's anti-dumping questionnaire in October 2018. And so, you know, we would submit that in sitting kind of on their arguments for over 8 months and waiting only until they were found to have misreported at verification to bring up these arguments, they are in fact late, and Gigi Zara has not contested that in their reply brief.
Okay.
Finally, just the last point I wanted to make, Your Honor, on ambiguity. I know we've been back and forth on this quite a bit. I would submit that if the department's instructions had said to report protein content with nothing more, Gigi Zara might have a more sympathetic argument that there was some sort of latent ambiguity here. The reason they do not is because the department added the clause as stated on the label of the respective product. Once that additional clause was added, the department removed all ambiguity from the reporting instructions. And even now in their reply brief, it seems that plaintiffs acknowledge their argument may be better characterized as a flaw in the reporting instructions rather than an ambiguity. But in either case, it doesn't save the timeliness issue with plaintiff's argument in that they did not raise it until verification.
Okay.
And with that, Your Honor, I will save the remainder of our arguments for on shape coding and AFA for after the other counsel have had their chance to speak.
Good. Thank you very much. Mr. Simon.
Yes, Your Honor. I have a few comments that I'd like to make in rebuttal to on the protein issue, and then I can move forward with the others if that's all right with you.
Yes.
Just to be clear, and I think counsel for the government was clear on this, this is not a facts available case. After the verification, Commerce issued a supplemental questionnaire requiring us to
I got it. I understand.
Okay, good. All right. Then there has come up a bunch of times the issue of the previous Gigi Zara reviews. This is their third consecutive review. And there's nothing on the record here that makes us think that the companies did anything different here from what they did previously. The other two reviews were not verified, and we just don't have any reason to think anything was different. And I would point out that in the first of these three reviews, 15-16, the companies got 6.3%. In 16-17,
yes,
they got...
My question would have been, were the other two verified, and they weren't, and you've answered that question.
Yeah, okay. Then on the issue of whether the difference of the protein percentages is commercially significant in Pescara-Mare's terms, it seems to me to be a kind of a silly proposition to say it's not commercially different, significant, because it is this difference, the 1.4%, that is throwing the product from standard to premium. If that's not commercially significant, then the field is meaningless and should be omitted from the databases. Finally, this whole business that counsel for the petitioners goes into about comparing the U.S. to the premium product, this came up in their brief where they said they referred to a line in my brief in which I said you could get to the same result by keeping the U.S. as it is and converting everything else. And just arithmetically, that's the case. If you convert the entire home market database to n times 6.25, then the entire home market database will become premium pasta. And so the matches that are occurring now, that are occurring after Gigi makes its correction of U.S. standard to home market standard becomes, if you convert everything except the U.S. to the U.S. methodology, then the matches are all going to stay correct. You're going to be matching all of Gigi's U.S. sales to all of their home market sales, those that are currently classified as standard and those are currently classified as premium. They'll all become premium. And so you'll come back to basically a correct methodology. I know this is a little confusing because it's hard to visualize numbers from words.
So wouldn't the result be just the same result that Commerce came to?
Absolutely not, because when I compare a U.S. product, okay.
If it would fling all of the home sales into premium,
mm-hmm.
isn't that essential? Explain this to me. Why it would matter?
Let's assume that there is a price difference between premium and standard. And under the methodology that Commerce used in the final results, we are comparing the Gigi expensive pasta to home market. I take it back. We are comparing the Gigi less expensive pasta, their standard pasta, to home market product that is more expensive because it's premium. If we convert the entire home market database to protein, to a superior, a premium semolina code, the prices won't change. And so the U.S. pasta
I get your argument now.
All right. It makes me crazy, but
I'm glad
I don't have to talk about it anymore. Thank you. This business of caring about the label. The rhetoric was perhaps a little coarser than it should be for legal discourse. What I'm saying is the label is a proxy for the physical content of the pasta itself. And it's the physical it's the physical amount of protein that we really care about. And finally, on rebuttal, the one thing you did not hear is that Commerce's protein model match gives correct matches. And coming back to my starting point, you know, we said that their protein coding, Commerce's protein coding, causes physically identical goods to be reported as dissimilar and physically dissimilar goods to be reported as identical. The government doesn't deny this. The petitioner says, this is really not a commercially significant difference, but of course it is, because it throws everything from standard to premium. So I believe that the requirement of accuracy trumps the requirement of timeliness. There is no question that Commerce's methodology is giving a wrong result. And, I mean, if we assume that Gigi Zara have been using the same methodology all along, that explains why 6% became 90%. That's pretty much all I have on rebuttal.
Okay.
If you'd like, I can go to shape classification, or do you want to stop there for a moment?
No, let's go right to, if you're comfortable, let's go right to shape classification.
Your Honor, okay. Your Honor, John Kenkel, may I make one comment?
Yes.
Okay, John Kenkel on behalf of plaintiffs. I just want to address the three cases cited by defendant interveners when they said we did not respond to those three. All three had a factual pattern totally dissimilar to the case at bar. In those three cases, the information Commerce would have needed was not on the record, and because the request was made late by the respondents. Commerce, in the Maverick case, for example, the court held that Commerce did not have time, because the request was made so late in the case, Commerce did not have time to distribute to the various respondents initial questionnaires that would solicit the necessary information to adopt the model matching criteria. Here, we already have that information. It was submitted in the prior responses. That data is on the record, and therefore, citation to these cases is not on point.
Okay. I'm afraid I'm going to have to, let's see. Ms. Johnson, were you the one who brought these cases up?
Yes, Your Honor. And I think we've established they are all applicable, Your Honor, because they all deal with challenges to model matching criteria. Mr. Kenkel, I believe, just said that the information in this case had been on the record, but I think we've already established this Italian separate protocol for calculating protein was not on the record. Plaintiffs have admitted they did not submit it with their questionnaire responses or in any correspondence with the department until it was found at verification that they had misreported.
Mr. Kenkel?
But then they did. I asked Mr. Simon to confirm that they did.
No. It's David Simon. There's a mistake here. Early in the early part of the questionnaires, Commerce asks for the specifications and so forth of the product, and we provided the Italian statute or regulation that governs the measurement of protein.
Well,
it's in the Section D response.
When Ms. Johnson brought this up in her papers, did you reply to it in any way? Or the citation of these cases and their argument that went with them?
No, because, we had given that Italian standard in response to a request for it, but we did not raise this issue. I have explained that previously. It didn't come up. The matching issue did not come up until the verification.
Okay. Thank you. I'll try to sort this out. Let's go on to Usili and Kavatappi.
Kavatappi.
I was pretty close.
All right. Again, David Simon for Gigi and Zara. Historically, Commerce has, in the pasta cases, relied on the production speed to differentiate normal cuts from specialty cuts. So within all of the shortcuts that you typically see them in boxes or small bags in the supermarket, some of them run at a much faster speed than others. In fact, most of them run at a very high speed. The production throughput rate is relatively fast. There are a limited number of them, however, that are produced at a much slower speed for whatever reason. The reasons are not apparent on the record here, but there are production reasons for that. And in the appendix to the questionnaire, Commerce's shape classifications provide, among others, that Fusilli and Cavatappi are specialty shortcuts. They are among that subset of shortcuts that run at a slower speed. And we've given the throughput rates for these products in our brief. They're confidential, very confidential. But what we can see is that normal shortcuts run about 40% faster than specialty shortcuts. The Gigi's Fusilli runs about 50% faster than specialty shortcuts. And the Zara's Fusilli runs about 30% faster than specialty shortcuts. I'm rounding all these figures the way we would for a questionnaire response. And DG and Zara, Zara is a huge company, by the way. It has three separate production plants. It's all on the record. It's the second largest pasta producer in Italy. So it's huge and it's state-of-the-art. Gigi is not so huge, but they have one factory and it's a good-sized factory. in addressing the issue, and we simply coded Fusilli and Cavatappi as normal shortcuts without disclosing anything, without asking anything. We did it. It's readily apparent from the record, from the Section B and C questionnaire response. It's readily apparent that we did it, because you can look in the questionnaire response and see what coding was applied to what shape. But we didn't draw any particular attention to it. We just did it. We have provided data showing that the Fusilli and Cavatappi pricing to the U.S. is substantially below our pricing for shortcuts. And I don't want to get into those numbers, but they're in the brief at 35 and 37. According to the lead case on all this is Pescara-Mares. And Pescara-Mares, in that case, Commerce had examined the difference in the grading standards in a number of countries to decide whether there was a separate category for super premium versus premium product based on color. So it wasn't a simple arithmetic test. It was a qualitative test. In the Union Steel case, which we cite in our brief, it's 73F sub second 1317. The court says, it's a 2011 case, by the way, at CIT. The court says that, quote, price and production cost are relevant to but not determinant of the issue of whether a physical difference has commercial significance. The court says, quote, it is difficult to envision how the physical differences separating the two groups of products at issue could be considered to be minor and commercially insignificant unless the two groups of product are viewed by customers as generally equal or interchangeable in the marketplace. So our general proposition is that products that have different individual shapes can have the same shape code only if the differences between them are not commercially significant. And back in 1995, Commerce made this distinction solely on the basis of production speed. I don't see anything in the 1990, there is nothing in the 95 decision to show whether Commerce considered the production speed to be of such commercial significance that it compels the exclusion of other commercial of other considerations like marketing and pricing.
But when this decision was made in 1995, I take it if Commerce relied on speed, production speed, mm-hmm. Did Commerce take up any other factors?
There's no indication that they did at all.
All right.
And I find it hard to imagine that production speed makes any difference to anybody at any level in the chain of distribution. When I go into the supermarket, I couldn't care less whether this pasta runs faster than that pasta. It has no commercial consequence to me except maybe insofar as it goes into price. But even that, you know, that's a questionable proposition. If I'm a manufacturer and I have a bunch of products that run at a bunch of different speeds, I'll just take the average and I'll put whatever, 50% on top of that as my selling price. So it's not at all clear to me that a manufacturer takes the throughput rate of every individual product into account in pricing its products. We see price lists in pasta, they are not by shape by shape. They're simply by product, by pasta. It's what is called line pricing. All of the standard pasta products are priced at the same price. So the manufacturer is absorbing differences in throughput rates by line pricing. And all of the respondents, in the mandatory respondents in this review, market Fusilli and Cavatappi as standard shortcuts. And when I say all, I mean it makes it sound like a huge universe, but there were actually only three, Gigi, Zara, and Indalco, which is Colavita. And but they accounted for the vast majority of all pasta imported by respondents subject to this review. So they all treated both of these products as the same, as standard shortcut, normal shortcuts. Then I want to address a real problem in the government's brief, because they're saying something that is not so, and it makes a difference. The government says that model matching is done on a product-specific basis, so that my Fusilli is always matched to my U.S. Fusilli is always matched to my home market Fusilli, regardless of the shape code. And that is simply not true. The CONNUM drives everything. And I gave in my reply brief a short snip from the commerce margin calculation, and you can see that the product comparisons never refer to a individual shape, Fusilli, Cavatappi, what have you. They only refer to the shape code. Now, what difference does that make? If my Fusilli in the U.S. always matches my home market Fusilli, then I don't really care if it's a 5 or a 6, because the Fusilli will be priced as a Fusilli in both markets. But when you use the shape code only, then if my Fusilli to the U.S. is a 5, a standard shortcut, a normal shortcut, then it's compared to all the normal shortcuts in the home market. But if my U.S. Fusilli becomes a 6, it's compared to that small subset of products in the home market that are specialty shortcuts. So, the government's brief really it presents a misleading picture of how the calculation is done, and it makes it seem like, what does GG care about this if Fusilli always matches Fusilli? But it doesn't. that if Fusilli is a 5, it matches all the home market 5s. If it's a 6, it matches all the home market 6s. And that's and that means that if Fusilli is a 6, it's being matched to the most expensive products in the home market. And I've looked really closely at the La Molisana case, and I don't think it's driven by this, but I really can't tell, and I didn't go back and look at the briefs to the court. But if commerce is explaining itself in this way in this case, I'm really concerned about whether other courts looking at pasta cases, other judges on the CIT looking at pasta cases have been kind of misled. I think it needs a fresh look. I also believe this, that commerce has said, we're not going to entertain any changes in anything that's on our in our standard appendix. And I do not think that that litigating by irrebuttable presumptions is an appropriate way to go. Or put another way, I don't think that commerce can lawfully impose such a high bar on reviewing shape codes that nobody can ever surmount that bar. And you know, the throughput rates of a manufacturer are deep, deep secrets, because they change according to the everything, the equipment, the pressures, the temperatures. It's very secret stuff. So no individual respondent is ever going to assemble a database of all the throughput rates of all the companies. It's impossible. And it's virtually impossible for any respondent to assemble a dossier of all of the marketing information of all the manufacturers or all the exporters, because that stuff is not publicly available. So there is no way for respondents to meet the extremely high bar for reviewing of shape codes. So to sum it up real quickly, DG and Zara produce Fusilli and Cavatappi at normal shortcut rates, not at specialty shortcut rates. They price them at normal shortcut rates. They market them at normal shortcut rates. And they should be considered as normal shortcuts. And any system that refuses to consider evidence that's available to the respondents as an appropriate standard is just not a workable system. That's what I have to say about shape codes. I can stop there if you like.
Why don't we stop there?
Okay.
Ms. B?
Thank you, Your Honor. I have several points to address regarding shape codes, but I would like to start with the initial matter, plaintiff's argument that the Department of Commerce has somehow been running some sort of years-long con on this court regarding how products are compared to each other. We, of course, take exception to this and completely dispute it. As far as the other cases go, I was not personally involved in them, so I can't represent it exactly what Commerce stated, but the decisions do not reflect at all that even if Commerce made misrepresentations, which I seriously doubt is the case, that the court's decisions in those cases, particularly La Molisana, would have turned on those representations. As regards the current case, I don't believe that we have made a misrepresentation as to how Fusilli, for example, is compared. We may have stated it somewhat inartfully, and if we did, we apologize, and it's certainly not with the intention of deceiving this court. We did say that Fusilli can be compared to other Fusilli, but I think what we meant is, and is clarified by the next part of that phrase, is in the absence of an identical match, Fusilli can be compared to other pasta in shape code 6. And I think that that sentence, in the absence of an identical match, makes it clearer that we're not trying to represent that Fusilli is always compared to other Fusilli in the first instance. My understanding of this, and petitioner can correct me if my understanding is incorrect, is that if there are identical matches between products as a whole, then those identical products are compared against each other. If there are not completely identical matches, then a particular Fusilli product would be compared against something else with that same conum and same shape code. So I apologize to the extent there was any unclarity about this, but I think it's important to note that we were not misrepresenting anything, and that even if we were accidentally misrepresenting something, that we don't think that this court's decision turns at all, or even if it does, it would be very minorly on this specific point. And I don't think plaintiff has established in either its argument or its briefing that this court's decision should turn at all in whether Fusilli is always first compared to other non-identical Fusilli, or whether it's compared to something else in its shape code category. Because even if Fusilli were reclassified to a shape code 5, it still wouldn't be compared to other Fusilli. It would just then be compared to another shape code, and therefore presumably would result in a lower dumping margin for plaintiffs. The next points I just want to get to are ones that I think, as I alluded to in the first part of my argument, really apply to both the protein content and the shape code classification. However, the situation is even more egregious with regard to the shape classification than with regard to the protein content. Like with the protein content, this methodology has been around for several years, and Fujizara has been subject to this shape code classification in its two prior reviews, as well as this review. But as I said, it's even more egregious than the protein content, because Fujizara at least has something vaguely resembling a colorable claim of a flaw or ambiguity, although we, of course, dispute that with regard to the protein content. Here, Fujizara has absolutely nothing to rest on. The Commerce instruction explicitly told Gigi and Zara to report based on the Appendix 3, which contains the shape classification table, unless those products were not already listed. Gigi Zara completely admit that Fusilli and Cavatappi were both listed in that appendix. And Gigi and Zara, I believe, certified that they complied with Commerce's instructions, even though they actually just reported Fusilli and Cavatappi as a different code than what Commerce specifically put forth in its appendix. So I don't think we can just ignore the fact that Gigi and Zara blatantly failed to comply with Commerce's very clear, very specific instructions and only raised these issues once Commerce caught that misrepresentation during verification. The second overarching issue that, again, applies to both protein content and this is what the Federal Circuit said in APEX, which is that the court won't second-guess Commerce's methodologies because it is afforded significant deference in determining its methodology, and that includes a product method matching methodology, which is, of course, a fact-based determination in the large part. The other reason why the shape code situation is even more egregious than the protein content situation as far as Fujizara's actions is because here we have an exactly on-point, virtually indistinguishable case in La Molisana. And I think it's interesting to note that plaintiff basically ignores La Molisana with the exception of saying that they wonder if Commerce's purported misrepresentation may have affected the court. First of all, there is no indication in the court's decision in La Molisana that that any sort of representation, if it was even made, would have affected that decision. But secondly, and I think as both we and petitioners pointed out in our brief, there is simply no room to distinguish between La Mola Sana and this case. And while it's true that the Court of Federal Circuit's affirmation of the La Mola Sana decision was not a reported decision, it still remains that the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit did affirm the La Mola Sana decision, and that that case is, again, indistinguishable in any meaningful respect from the present case. And not only is there La Mola Sana, but this court also in the Prodotti case a few years earlier, again, specifically upheld Commerce's shape-matching methodology and went so far as to say that even if certain products are produced on the same machines at similar speeds, that does not necessarily establish they are the same product. I also just want to point to another part of La Mola Sana, because that issue actually goes specifically to one that plaintiff has raised in its argument today, and that has to do with its allegation that Commerce only considered line speed in the investigation and when initially putting forth its initial shape codes. La Mola Sana, I think, makes clear that that's not the case, because the court notes in the La Mola Sana decision that Commerce's position is that the throughput rate to distinguish pasta shape was only a part of the description of the development of the model match methodology in the original investigation and its refinement in subsequent reviews, which circumstance does not indicate that it is only production speed that distinguishes special and regular cuts. I unfortunately
don't... Did you try to find what Commerce actually said at that time, rather than on this case?
I unfortunately don't have the investigation in front of me. We can, of course, file it with this court if the court would like. So I unfortunately only have the statement from the La Mola Sana case, but I don't think there's necessarily any reason to doubt that statement, but I can certainly go back and then look more closely at the investigation record. And that, I think, especially, so that statement, that throughput speed was not the only consideration, combined with the fact that Commerce's practice, when it comes to determining new pasta shapes, which does apparently happen sometimes, shows that it's not just the throughput speeds that are in classifying new shapes, but it also considers things like descriptions and pictures and the type of production machine or line that's used in the standard production
capacity. There's nothing on the record that would indicate that that happened in this case. Is that right?
That wouldn't have happened in this case because we weren't dealing with new pasta products.
When, in 1995.
I don't think there's anything on the record of this case that shows that that happened in 1995. There may be something in the public investigation IDM or something like that, but I unfortunately don't have that in front of me right now. Perhaps.
Well, I wouldn't say that the current practice necessarily is particularly...
I would just say that I don't think plaintiff's allegation about line speed is necessarily true. And I will also say that I think plaintiff misrepresents the situation to say that Commerce will never entertain changes to shape classification categories once they've been determined. As both we and defendant interveners have explained, Commerce will entertain them if the person asking or if the entity asking for a classification change has presented compelling reasons to do so. And I don't think that plaintiffs are necessarily disputing that there's something wrong with the standard of requiring a compelling reason. Rather, they seem to dispute that under Commerce's interpretation of it having to be something that's not company-specific, but rather across the industry, that that's an impossible standard. And I don't believe that that's true. To start with, it's not only throughput speeds, which I know plaintiff of course, focuses on, and I would concede that they don't likely have access to other companies' throughput speeds, except maybe in the course of litigation, which, of course, is tightly guarded, but that Commerce never has cabined this compelling change to only apply to throughput speeds. I think it has mentioned, I'm not sure where, but I seem to remember there being a mention of a respondent being able to demonstrate an industry-wide change in technology, for example, and that would be something that any given respondent should theoretically have access to. Or if enough different individuals even brought up throughput speeds on their own, then Commerce might consider that enough to show industry-wide. Or if they were showing things like type of production or description picture, the same type of things that Commerce tends to rely upon when classifying news shapes, then Commerce could consider that, and not all of that would be as protected as the throughput speeds. But I just want to say that I do think that La Molisana is, while not binding on this court, of course, between La Molisana and Prodotti, that's extremely persuasive, especially when coupled with the Court of Federal of Appeals for the Federal Circuit's affirmance of La Molisana and the reason.
Okay, I got this.
Okay, thank you. And just one last point, and that has to do with plaintiffs' more specific descriptions of throughput speeds and fusilli. I will try to be careful in my statements here because I know that some of the information is confidential, so I'll try to keep it in broad strokes. But one is that on page 33 of plaintiff's briefs, plaintiff is very clearly selectively choosing which type of fusilli to rely on in talking about throughput speeds. And I think that petitioner, I don't remember if it's in their response brief to this court or in their rebuttal case brief, but I think petitioner has pointed out that if you include other types of plaintiff's fusilli, some of those types of fusilli are made at different speeds than the ones that plaintiff is choosing to rely on here. So I don't think it's necessarily accurate for plaintiff to say that fusilli is definitely made at a category 5 speed rather than a category 6 speed when it's limiting its the fusilli it's talking about to like a very specific subset of fusilli rather than their overall fusilli. And finally, and again, I'll try to be careful with what I say about this, but plaintiff has pointed out that in their brief, they list a whole bunch of pastas that are in Category 5 and a whole bunch of pastas that are in Category 6. And I think the attempt that plaintiff is making here is to show that Category 6 pastas are at lower speeds than Category 5 pastas. But if Your Honor looks at the breakdown of the pastas on that list, you'll see that while that may be true as an overall concept, that that's not necessarily true of every specific pasta. And I'll leave it at that so as not to go into BPI, but I'll note that there is not necessarily the case that every pasta in Category 6 is faster than every pasta in Category 5. And so I think that detracts from plaintiff's claim that just because fusilli and cavatappi might have faster pasta speeds, that automatically means it should be a Category 5 pasta. And with that, I will rest on the shape classification argument. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Johnson?
Thank you, Your Honor. I don't actually have a whole lot more to add over what the government said. I would just point out briefly, because I think it's sort of helpful in terms of illustrating what these identical merchandise may be, that the pasta shapes, if you go to Appendix 3, show, you know, dozens and dozens of different shapes are all categorized as, you know, a 5 or a 6 within the same category. So just another illustration to show that goods that are not physically identical, because they are different shapes, have been determined by Commerce to be not commercially significant. So their differences are not commercially significant, therefore they are still under Commerce's view identical. And so I think in terms of what we were speaking about earlier with protein content, that sort of helps just illustrate that goods which are not, you know, physically identical can still be identical under Commerce's regulations.
And this is true with 6, too, then, right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
How many would you say were under 6?
You know, I'm looking at the Appendix 3, and it's done alphabetically, so I have not counted out. But if you look at the record, I mean, it's I think it's approximately 250 or 300 different cuts, all of which are categorized into. Yeah, it's dozens, I would say, for sure. And then we disagree with what the government has said about plaintiffs' failure to really distinguish La Moisana, which I think is very factually analogous to this case, and would also note that in their reply brief, it seems for the first time, plaintiffs are arguing for some kind of industry-wide adoption of a change to this shape coding, but we certainly didn't see any argument to that effect in their opening brief. And also just note that, that their arguments on reply that it would be difficult to get industry-wide data does not necessarily undermine the holding of La Moisana. And obviously with this court and the department's protective orders, we frequently have to consolidate industry-wide data and keep that data protected from, competitors in the same industry. So I would just note that doesn't in any way undermine the holding of La Moisana.
Okay.
Your Honor, this is David Smith. I actually was involved in the original investigation and have been involved in every segment of this proceeding. So if the court would find it helpful, I can speak a little bit about how these classifications were adopted back then. If not, I'm happy to remain quiet.
Yeah,
pardon me?
Is it on the record?
No. Like much of this conversation, it isn't. It's about what happened earlier.
Right.
And Commerce brought it all up again in the 12th and 15th review when they added protein content. They went back and looked at this and spoke about it. But I have been involved in all 23 segments, so I was just offering to provide some background.
No thanks.
Surely. Okay.
It's kind of you to offer. Mr. Simon.
Yes, Your Honor, I had to unmute my phone, and I was looking at something on the side while we were talking. I do have a few points in rebuttal. You were just asking about the number of shapes in the different categories in the appendix. And in our reply brief at page 17, we tell you that Gigi and Zara have, and this is not bracketed, 220 different shortcuts and 61 different specialty shortcuts. And there are a huge number of shapes in the appendix that are unique to individual producers. So it's not a good idea to think about how many shapes are this or that in the appendix. But in terms of, say, the Fagersta stainless criterion for a compelling reason to change a model, the fact is that we have four times as many shortcuts as we do specialty shortcuts. So it gives us there are many more potential matches for Fusilli and Cavatappi when they're considered as shortcuts. I don't think it's dispositive, but you asked it, I think, just out of interest, and there's the answer.
Okay.
Counsel for the government, I believe, suggested that we were engaged in some selectivity in our tables on throughputs, and yes, we did, but there's an important reason for that. Pasta is extruded through a die, through little holes. And the die can be either Teflon or bronze. Obviously, the Teflon dies are a later development. And in fact, pasta that goes through a Teflon die can be processed at a much higher speed than pasta that goes through a bronze die, and for reasons relating to the friction that's generated by the bronze. So we excluded the bronze die Fusilli from our throughput tables for precisely that reason. It's not from a manufacturing point of view, it's not right to lump the Teflon dye and the bronze dye into the same throughput universe. And in regard to the claims that La Molisana isn't distinguishable, we did address that a couple places in our reply brief, but at the end of the day, the court in La Molisana looked at the throughput rates. We're saying something more than that. We're saying that the Commerce needs to look at the throughput rates, but also at the commercial practices of the mandatory respondents, which you can readily see from their catalogs. There's a page of specialty cuts, and there's page after page of normal cuts. So it's not, and that's public. So it's not difficult to see how the respondents are categorizing these things in the marketplace. The catalog goes to the marketplace, of course. And the other thing that La Molisana didn't talk about was the issue of whether Commerce can lawfully impose a burden of proof that nobody can meet. It just doesn't come up in La Molisana, and it comes up in our argument. With that, that's all I have on shape codes, and we can move to the payment dates if you like.
Okay, fine.
Okay. The payment date issue relates to Gigi's U.S. affiliate. Gigi is an Italian company. Let me back up a little bit. Gigi and Zara are affiliated with each other because Zara has ownership interest in Gigi, some percentage of their shares. Gigi, in turn, has a U.S. affiliate named Gigi Food Industries, GFI. And Commerce conducted verification at GFI's offices in Manassas, Virginia, which frankly was very nice for me, convenient. GFI submitted two databases. Actually, the GFI databases are included in the overall U.S. sales database that is submitted to Commerce. But in the two U.S. sales databases that were submitted to Commerce, for GFI, the pay dates in the first database were consistent with the actual payment dates reflected in the 17 transactions that Commerce examined at verification. In the second database, USO2, the payment dates were garbled. There was some kind of programming error, and as a result of that, they were garbage. They were just garbled. And no, we didn't realize it until we have to look at them in detail preparing for the verification. So we said to Commerce, you know that the payment dates in the USO1 database were accurate. You know that because for every sale you looked at verification, the USO1 payment date was correct. And Commerce says, well, no, we're going to apply AFA to the GFI payment date because we have a practice, a consistent practice, that we will only use the database that we examined at verification for purposes of a final result, when there's a verification, of course, which was the case here. And it is our argument that, first of all, facts available, much less adverse facts available is not applicable because there is no gap in the record. the record is complete. Second, Commerce's refusal to use the US01 database on the basis of a consistent policy is an unsupported proposition because if Commerce claims a consistent policy, it is required to show that it is a policy that they apply consistently. And there is no evidence that Commerce has applied consistently the policy that when there are multiple databases, they will only use the database that was subject to the verification. excuse me. In order to apply AFA, Commerce has to make an objective showing that a reasonable and responsible importer would have been able to provide the data, and a subjective showing that the respondent failed to cooperate by not maintaining records or failing to put maximum effort into acquiring the information. But here, KG was able to and did provide the information, and KG, or GFI actually, put its maximum effort into acquiring the information. And we can see they did that because the US01 database was correct. And the programming error that garbled the US02 database was really out of the hands of the respondent. So our position is that Commerce does not have a consistent policy of only using the database examiner verification. And in this particular case, where there were only two databases, and it was readily apparent, and we gave them chapter and verse statistically on this, that the US01 pay dates were correct for all of the sales verified at verification, Commerce was wrong to find that there was a gap in the record and to fill it with AFA. I might have some points on rebuttal, but that's what I have on the payment dates.
Okay. Ms. Beck?
Thank you, Your Honor. I will try to keep this brief since I know we've been going for a while. I just have a few things to say about the sales database issue. The first is that I don't believe that plaintiffs are contesting Commerce's initial determination to reject the database revision as a minor correction. And because plaintiff is not, I just wanted to make clear that in our view, at least, plaintiff is not contesting that decision, but rather only Commerce's decision to find facts available with an adverse inference for rather than relying on the US01 database. Turning to the US. Thank you.
That's what it sounds like to me.
Thank you. And turning to that, the next issue I want to raise is that plaintiff argues in its reply brief and here that Commerce has not established that its practice of relying on the most recent sales database at verification is indeed a practice because, according to plaintiff, Commerce has only pointed to, I think, two instances in the PDM and IDM and in our brief as to which Commerce relied on this practice of using the most recent database. I would say to that that...
Can I interrupt you for just a second?
Sure, Your Honor.
So we're talking about a practice, not a policy. Is that right?
I believe it's a practice. It may indeed be a policy. I know we have referred to it as a practice in the brief, but it may be an actual policy.
If you only call it a practice, we're going to look at it as a practice. There's a difference between the two.
Thank you, Your Honor. I think it's a practice, but I would need to...
Your representations up to this point are fine with me.
Thank you, Your Honor. Sorry, I lost my train of thought very briefly. Oh, what I was going to say to that is, at least to my impression, the first time that plaintiff has questioned whether Commerce's practice is actually a practice or whether it's sufficient to constitute a practice. I think that the first time that plaintiff has explicitly questioned this is in its reply brief. I don't believe it raised that Commerce's practice was invalid or, in fact, not a practice down below or even in, really in its opening brief. And I'm sure Mr. Simon will correct me if I have somehow misinterpreted those documents. But to the extent that that's the case, we would say that plaintiff has failed to exhaust that argument, and so the court should not consider it. And at the very least, if the court finds that it has been raised tangentially, then the only time that plaintiff has raised it directly, I think, is in its reply brief and in this argument. So if that were the case, then we would request that, you know, we be permitted, or if the court decides to remand, to simply have Commerce explain its practice further and cite previous instances of it rather than overturning it completely.
So maybe this is the wrong time to ask this, but if I wanted to find evidence that this practice has been recorded someplace, where would I look?
Your Honor, as far as I'm aware, the only way to do that would have to be to, well, I would start with the citations to that we actually cited for, I think, two previous reviews in this particular product. And then I think beyond that, we would probably need to, my plan at least would have been to confer with Commerce to find other instances across
That's
different
good.
Products. Right. I unfortunately don't know of a more streamlined way to do it.
Okay, I understand.
Thank you, Your Honor. The next point I want to bring up is with regard to plaintiff's point that Commerce was not allowed to find facts available here, and that's simply not the case. The relevant statutes very specifically provides that that Commerce may use facts available when a respondent provides information, but the information cannot be verified. Here, and I know, again, this dovetails a little bit with whether the recent database thing is a practice or not, Commerce did attempt to verify the payment dates in the U.S. O2 sales database. So it did actually undertake the verification on that database. GGZARA did not object to the verification, as far as I'm aware, of that database, and Commerce was unable to verify the U.S. payment dates. So therefore, Commerce adhered exactly to the statute in relying on facts available where the database it did verify in fact contained unverifiable information, and plaintiff cannot point to...
Would this be then the first time that Commerce has ever accepted different information and verification?
I'm not sure I completely understand Your Honor's question.
Well, has it never been the case that when the information that was subject to verification, the respondent said, no, it's all wrong. This is the information you should look at. Has it never been the case that Commerce has said, oh, okay, we'll look at this information?
Your Honor, I unfortunately don't think I could say off the top of my head, even more broadly, and certainly not with regard to something, anything specific with regard to the U.S. payment dates, but even more broadly, I can't say as to whether Commerce has definitely or definitely not agreed to accept different information in lieu of unverifiable information, or whether Commerce has determined to accept similar information as a minor correction, unlike not accepting it here. So unfortunately, I'm not able to answer that question directly. Potentially, Mr. Simon will,
okay.
But they haven't. Okay. I will point out that plaintiff did not cite any cases or administrative reviews in its brief to that effect, so that indicates that plaintiff may not be aware of any either, or at least they didn't cite it. I don't think that plaintiff has also been able to point to any sort of requirement that once Commerce has tried to verify and been unable to verify due to plaintiff's own fault, information during verification that is then required to go try to verify other information, and then if that fails, potentially have to verify other information on top of that. So I don't think that plaintiff can necessarily say, number one, that Commerce is required to verify, to make a second attempt to verify once their first attempt has failed due to plaintiff's own error. And second of all, I don't think they can definitively say that it's verifiable when Commerce has not, in fact, attempted to undertake that actual verification. I think plaintiff believes that it's verifiable, and it very well may be, but Commerce did not actually verify the US-01 database because it tried to verify the US-02 database instead. And unless the court has any other questions, I would rest on this issue, and I would request that the court sustain Commerce's final results in full.
Okay, thank you very much. Ms. Johnson?
Thank you, Your Honor. The only thing I would add to the discussion of the application of AFA, and I will defer, obviously, to the department on whether this is a practice or a procedure, but I would just note one additional case I found to the extent it's helpful to the court. It's the issues and decision memorandum for monosodium glutamate from the Republic of Indonesia, July 19, 2019. And in that case, the respondent, sort of similar to petitioners here, had submitted a home market database, which upon preparation for verification found that there were a significant number of errors, tried to correct those errors prior to verification by submitting what it was calling minor clarifications, and the department rejected it and conducted a verification of its most recently submitted database, which was at that time its initial database, and found it was unable to verify and went ahead and applied AFA. So that's just one other example
Did some court look at this?
No, Your Honor. Getting to the fact of whether this is a practice or procedure for the department, I did find, you know, a case in which the department has been looking at the most recently submitted home database.
What year was that?
2019, Your Honor.
Okay. When did this verification take place?
For Gigi Zara, it took place in June and July of 2019.
It was monosodium glutamate before or after that?
July 19th, 2019, so right around the same time, Your Honor.
Same time? Okay. All right.
Mm-hmm. And that's all I had to add to that part of the argument.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Simon.
Thank you, Your Honor. You asked whether Commerce has ever essentially accepted different information from the information that was verified. I haven't exactly written down your words, but in the investigation in this case in 1995, Commerce found that Del Verde's U.S. payment dates were wrong because they hadn't been updated after the prelim. Del Verde submitted a post-verification database updating those payment dates. The petitioners objected. Commerce used the post-verification database, and they said, I quote, "We believe this approach is appropriate because it is consistent with our practice of promoting accuracy and completeness in the calculation of margins," end quote. And the site for that is 61 Federal Register, 30352, June 14, 1996. And then the government, and I don't have a lot to say, you'll be happy to know, the government sets forth a concern about a potential infinite regress of verifications. If they give us a new one, we have to verify that. If they give us another new one.
You don't have to address that.
No, but I do want to make one point, if I may. This is statistics. These are numbers. And we easily put the two databases side by side and showed the payment date in US-1, the payment date in US-2, and the verified payment date. So it's not a question of some sort of chain of verifications. They had the data. They had it from the beginning, and it's simply a matter we gave them the comparison. It is as if those U.S. 01 payment dates were verified. And with that, that completes what I have to say. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, thank you all. Is there anything else that we should take up? Any housekeeping matters? Any this, any that?
Not from my point of view. I think we're covered.
Not for
okay.
us, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Not from us.
In that case, court's adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. Good afternoon.
Thank you, Your Honor.